Hello and welcome to the Welsh Rugby Podcast. I'm your host, Ben James. I'm joined, as ever, by Stephen Thomas. The dust has settled. It's a few days since Wales were confirmed to be the holders of the Wooden Spoon for 2024, having lost their fifth and final match of the Six Nations, a winless Six Nations this year. Steph, the inquest in many ways has already started. You've done a podcast with one of our rivals, which I assume was an inquest of sorts. So you're probably well versed in talking about the issues at hand in Welsh rugby. I'm glad you turned up for that podcast because I hear some other people didn't. Some people who probably could do with speaking on the topic.
I was promoting Wales Online to the world.
Yeah, I think there were some people who could have been on that podcast who weren't, but the less said about that, the better. It's been a funny few days since our last podcast and since the Wales game. Obviously, the last podcast was done a couple of hours after the game when things were still fresh. Warren Gatland's resignation was still sort of hanging in the air, his offer. Since then, we've had Gatland make an appearance on Scrum 5. Now the dust is starting to settle on basically a wooden spoon. So I guess then it begs the question of where do we go now? And even though it was shot down so quickly and emphatically, apparently, by Abby Tinney, I think Gatland's resignation is probably the place to start. What are your own views on that? Because, you know, I've spoken about it, I've wrote about it. It's a strange one, isn't it?
Yeah. I think Gatland was probably anticipating that the likes of myself and you were going to perhaps be writing about his future, given they finished bottom of the Six Nations, so decided to get ahead of the game. So I suppose in that sense, it's quite shrewd. However, I do think that if you were the chief exec, you might be a bit. We don't know, obviously, what the full conversation was. Perhaps she gave him permission, but yeah, I'm not sure whether the chief executive would have been happy with that. I think after a bad defeat like that, I think what you say is, you know, don't worry about it for now. We'll go away and we'll have a few days off, and then we'll review. But I think that the real sort of message behind this is that even if they wanted to, and I'm not saying they should, the W can't afford to sack Gatland and his assistants and then, you know, potentially identify a successor and have to buy him out of a contract and pay him and all the assistants he wants. So that's the real message behind this, that they can't afford a coaching overhaul again. I think when something goes wrong in sport or any business, really, in sport, obviously, the head coach is always the fall guy. He's the one that people point the finger at. But I think you've got to identify what the root cause of Wales' problems are. And it's not Warren Gatland. I think it's the regional game below it. We've said, you know, a number of times, people have been saying this for years, that the WIU have almost neglected that level of the game, and this demise was inevitable because you've got players like, for example, Cam Winnett and Mackenzie Martin, and they've never really been part of any winning environment, you know, and the gulf now between regional rugby and international rugby is almost too high. And I think we saw that the Wales performances in the Six Nations probably emphasise that. But in terms of Gatland, they can't afford to get rid of him, and I'm not sure, even if they could, that would be the answer.
No, it wouldn't. I don't think... Yeah, I agree that it probably isn't the answer. I think the issue lies in basically how it's been taken off the table so emphatically. And I know that's a diversion tactic, and it's basically so that we're not talking about, well, one, we're not talking about his future for the next few weeks. Two, we're probably not talking about maybe some of his coaching decisions and his selection decisions, because they've been coming under increased scrutiny. I think it, certainly in the last few weeks. But yeah, you know, we, for starters, we don't know if Abby Tierney is happy with that being out in the public domain. But I mean, if she is happy with it being out in the public domain, the question is why. Any CEO shouldn't be happy with that being, you know, that information being offered to the public, you know, half an hour after a game. You know, and also, if you're one of the players, what are your thoughts on that? Because Gatland's sort of message throughout this whole tournament has been building this narrative that we're at the start of a journey. There's a lot of negativity in Welsh rugby, which he said a lot. And he probably hasn't always helped in terms of dealing with that negativity. But his message has been, you know, we're at the start of this journey and it's going to take time. I know you can say that offering to fall on your sword after a wooden spoon is the right thing to do, but if you're one of the players, does that message then that, hey, you know, this is the start of the journey, we're all in it for the long haul, does that lose its effect if then the coach offers to walk at the first sign of trouble?
Yeah, I think it could be unsettling if you're a player, because that's the point I was making earlier, that a lot of these players might have been playing reasonably well individually, not perfect, but reasonably well and making progress. But that if you're not winning, I suppose your confidence is not going to be sky high. And they got these coaches and they're drumming into these players that they're good enough to play international rugby. But if you're not winning, there's no real evidence of that subconsciously. So I suppose if the head coach comes out and says, you know, and offers his resignation after a game, then you might be thinking, if you're a younger player, so only won a couple of caps, you might be thinking, well, does he think he's good enough? Does he think that we're not good enough? Is that why he's offering his resignation? Obviously, I understand why he's done it, because sometimes if you have such a disastrous campaign, you may think you're not the right man, and perhaps he just wanted to get ahead of the game and, you know, and take control of the situation. But yeah, I think if I was a player, I think I'd find it unsettling.
I suppose the other thing with Gatland at the minute is, and again, this is probably where maybe the resignation offer doesn't help, is I think there is a perception in some quarters that he is not as committed to the job as he could be. Certainly, I think some fans feel that, you know, there's things that he was probably forgiven for in his first spell because at the end of the day, Wales was successful. So, you know, some of those things in terms of what he gets up, you know, what he does outside of his work commitments, you know, in terms of going home to New Zealand, you know, speaking events, stuff like that. I think they're probably under more scrutiny than they were in his first spell. And there's almost more of an onus on him now to prove that he is committed to what is a massive job. And that's the position, you know, not saying he is committed, not saying he isn't committed, but that is a position that he has not been in, let's be honest, in the first 12 years of his Wales gig. I don't think anyone, never to this extent, people didn't question his commitment to the job, did they?
No, I mean, some of the stuff he's doing now, you know, going back to New Zealand, he went back to New Zealand for Christmas when the derbies are on, and straight after the Six Nations, he was doing things like that during his first stint in charge. But as you said, in the main, they were winning, so people sort of turned a blind eye to it. But at the end of the day, if it's in his contract, it's not Warren Gatland you need to blame, it's whoever drew up the contract. But I think in terms of the job he's got on his hands, you know, we all know he's a top-class coach. You know, he's been among the best in the world, but people need to remember the last time he coached Wales, they had the best crop of players since the 1970s. They had a certain type of player as well. Like, they had a pack that could go toe-to-toe with anyone, especially in his early days with people like Adam Jones, Gethin, Smiler, you know, Arlen Wynn, Ian Evans, Chartres. You know, I could go on and on, couldn't I? But now they, you know, you analyse Wales' performances and they lack a lot of ball carriers. They've been bullied by a lot of packs up front, and if you lose a contact area, then you more often than not lose the game, don't you? And there's a lack of experience at 10. So I think this is undoubtedly the biggest challenge of his career, because I was thinking to myself last night, if he did go, say you put Scott Robertson in, not going to happen, obviously, or Joe Smith, would they do any better? And if there is an improvement, it would be minimal, because they just haven't got the players, and I don't think the structures are in place anymore for Wales to be successful. So I think that's the underlying root cause of everything. The professional arm of the game, you know, the regional game, isn't anywhere near where it should be. And until that's fixed, then, you know, success at international level is going to be very, very difficult to achieve.
Absolutely. It's no coincidence, is it, that first generation of players, you know, that the sort of when Gatlin came in, he literally came in and there was a 2008 under-20 squad that had done so well. And that's off the back of the first 5 years of regionalism when the teams were funded appropriately.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's no coincidence that when the domestic game was funded properly, then it built the foundations for basically Gatlin's whole reign.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the great irony that they sort of half, you know, that changed within Gatlin's reign, and he limped through to the end with that generation and probably got out at the right time, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. You got a few bits.
And now he's back to sort of deal with the consequences of it. Which is what makes it amazing then, that some people want to pin the fact that we haven't blooded youngsters on Wayne Pivac, because it's so much deeper than that, isn't it? You know, Pivac handed out caps like they were going out of fashion. And he did it in a harder context, because he didn't have, you know, he had less summer tours. He had a lot more autumn, you know, he basically had autumn games in Six Nations, a lot of competitive matches. You look at the cap breakdown of each World Cup cycle. I think he probably handed out more caps in his 75% World Cup cycle than Gatland has in any of his full ones. And he did that without having a summer tour. In a line, I mean, they had Argentina and Canada, didn't they? But that was in Wales, and it wasn't sort of a full. He missed out on a summer tour the year before that, which would have been New Zealand and Japan, which could have offered him the chance for some caps. He capped about 18 players in autumn games, which is considerably more than Gatlin ever capped in autumn games. I think he capped as many players in Six Nations games as Gatlin has done in a World Cup cycle. And, you know, you look back at Gatlin's times, he's had games against the Barbarians quite a lot, including cap games against the Barbarians, which is almost unprecedented to have a cap game against the Barbarians. So that's where he's been able to put out a lot of his caps. So, yeah, the notion that Pivac didn't, you can criticise Pivac for many things. He didn't stick with those players that he capped as much as he could have, and he probably was too convoluted with his selection. And the irony now is probably the group of players that Wales have right now suits him more than the players he had at the time. You can lay all that at Pivac's door, but you can't really lay the whole idea of succession planning at his door. That ostensibly comes back to Gatland's first reign, and just not even Gatland within Gatland's first reign, just the fact that, you know, people have been asleep at the wheel for so long when it comes to the Welsh Rugby Union and their handling of the professional game.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote in my verdict piece on Saturday that this is the legacy of Roger Lewis and Steve Phillips, and I stand by that. Like, they would say that, oh, look at the accounts. Look at the accounts at the time when Roger Lewis was there. You know, they were really healthy. But that's the whole point, isn't it? When the Welsh Rugby Union had a lot more money, a lot more wealth, it didn't trickle down to the regional game and to the semi-professional game. It was a top-heavy approach, but they didn't have the foresight to realise that unless you service the regional game to the level it should have been, far more than they did, then eventually success would stop up top. And this is where we are. You know, we had a golden generation of player, Gatland and Pivac, I suppose, in his early years, sucked every last drop out of it. But the players coming through aren't as good as those that came before them. And some of that is just the natural cycle of sport, but it didn't have to be this way. A lot of that is because, you know, the pathways have, and the regions have got to take some blame as well, but the pathways have been, you know, they got very stale there, and the regional game's just not strong enough. And I was talking to a regional coach last week, and, you know, I'm sure you'll agree, Morgan Morse is a top-class prospect, as good as you find it in the UK, but Munster or Leinster have 6 or 7 Morgan Morses, for example, and that's the problem. And unfortunately, when they brought Warren Gatland back after getting rid of Pivac, and I'm not saying it was the wrong appointment, but they expected him to have a magic wand and fix it, and they had a reasonably decent World Cup, although they should have done better. But there's no quick fixes anymore because the players aren't there. The system isn't geared to our success because it's just been starved of oxygen for so long, and we are where we are. And until we fix what's underneath the national side, then you know, sustained success is not really possible, in my opinion.
Absolutely, and that's the thing that sort of frustrates me when you talk of a golden generation. Is it almost implies that it's there by fluke, like it's a once in a lifetime group of players? Well, occasionally, yeah, you are going to get a group of players that is a bit better than other generations. But there just almost seems to be this mindset that, oh, well, you know, we're so lucky to have all these players at once. But other countries just don't have that because there's the continual churn of having the system in place. You know, we didn't get this golden generation by chance. It's come from probably, you know, a lot of decisions made in the first part of the noughties that built all the way up to 2008 when that 20s team did so well. And then on, you know, back when the regions were competitive, when they were in Anglo-Welsh semi-finals, finals every year, Heineken Cup semi-finals for a stretch. You know, it's not all a coincidence that the golden generation came off the back of success and, you know, proper investment at the professional level. And, you know, funny enough, I've seen like comments from South African fans and other countries who are sort of perplexed by this golden generation idea because they're like, well, yeah, but then you just have the next generation and you should be, you know, that should just come naturally. Whereas for us, it's almost like, yeah, we're just bereft now. And we're sort of confused as to where it's all coming from. It's it's frustrating, isn't it? And I guess, you know, that brings us then on to what does happen with the professional game. You know, as we know, the budgets are going down next year to 4.5 million. Speaking on Scrum 5, Gatland didn't necessarily seem to think that was too little a figure to compete, which is alarming, I think, in many ways. I think, judging by previous comments he's made in the tournament, I think his concern is that the regions basically waste money on what he would see as foreign imports, which I just don't think is going to happen. At the end of the day, the regions just need... they need squad numbers. They can't train properly, really, can they? You know, in the last few weeks, you've had Cardiff and the Dragons training together, Cardiff and Harlequins, Bristol and the Ospreys, if you look at most of the regions in the key positions, say like hooker, scrum half, they've got, in terms of sort of senior players who aren't academy players, probably two players, some of them. So that's in a training week, then you've got guys taking on 50% of the load, which severely limits what you can and can't do in terms of game planning and player welfare and just building for the week. You know, people can look at the number of games a player will play this year compared to, say, last year. And I don't know, I haven't probably looked at it, but there might not be a huge amount of difference, but it's the unseen stuff like that throughout the week that limits how much training you can do. Because, you know, if you want to do 15 on 15 in a session, that means that both your hookers, both your scrum halves have to be involved the whole time. That's the stuff that's going to really have an effect on the regions. And that's what shrinking budget is going to do, because the playing numbers just aren't there.
And also, you know, in terms of the national side, as you rightly mentioned, when you're playing at a higher level in knockout stages in Europe, then the gap between regional or club level and international is not as wide. So like when Andy Farrell was looking for a replacement for Sexton, you know, he saw Crowley guide Munster to victory in Toulon. And if you can do that at that level, you kind of know someone's test class. But how can you really identify whether someone's international class if they're playing in a Dragons team losing by 40 to 50 points to Glasgow? It's very difficult, isn't it? I think this strategic, this new strategy that they're going to be publishing in June, and I understand a lot of people are quite sceptical about that because there's been so many reviews into Welsh rugby, you know, lost count, but it's just vital because we're at such a crossroads. Ideally, what we need is to give the four professional teams more money, an injection of cash, sustainable money, so that they can grow. But then you think, well, where's that coming from? I know people compare the Irish turnover to the IUs, but it's surplus that counts, really. And there's things in Ireland that Wales couldn't do, like the tax break for a professional sportsman. There's no VAT on tickets, a private school system. So I think the Irish comparison is not a helpful one because it's not an accurate one. And you just look around Welsh rugby and you think, you know, you want to keep as many professional teams. You want to keep four teams, but then you think, well, is there enough professional level players to service four? At the moment, there isn't. So do they try and cut a team? If they want to do that, how do they do that? If they want to keep four, where do they get the money from to properly fund four? Or do they go to an aggressive tiered funding system? And, you know, they'd never agree. So that's the key point. We've had some meaningful ideas put forward to the PRB in the past and its predecessors, and it's come close to going to getting past the board, but it's fallen at the last hurdle, like the Scarlet Ospreys merger in 2019. So that's my worry, that because you have to have a consensus of a certain amount of people agreeing on things, and so much self-interest, understandably, are you going to be able to get any meaningful change through? That's what I think the big problem is. And that's not me saying I think we should go down to 3-year tiered funding system, but we do need to do something dramatic, something really, you know, it needs to be drastic change, but I don't know if there will be, because you have to have so many people agreeing. That's the biggest worry for me.
Indeed. It's funny you mentioned the aggressive tiered funding system. So I heard an interesting hypothetical yesterday, which, I mean, would probably never happen because of just the outroar there would be. But the suggestion was from someone that maybe they should look at turning Cardiff into effectively the Leinster.
Have you heard that?
Fund them, but stick with me because it gets more interesting. Put them in the Premiership, the English Premiership. The other three, that's the question. The other three stay in the URC. You'd have less trouble probably finding a replacement for Cardiff in the URC than you would getting Cardiff into the Premiership, because, you know, this talk of Scotland potentially thinking of a third team, the Cheetahs would happily jump at the chance. Black Lion in Georgia would love the chance. Well, yeah, if Cardiff take their place in the Premiership, then maybe Wasps would have to come to the URC. You know, because there's talk of Scotland having a London team, isn't there? So, you know, filling the URC spot, which presumably would be, well, I don't quite know what the WRU's deal with the URC, whether that would be their responsibility almost to fill that fourth spot or not. That would, in theory, be the easier part. But, I don't know, selling it to the English Premiership, the one Welsh team alone goes there. It's an interesting idea because you're banking on the fact that Cardiff had good Anglo-Welsh clashes this year. But then if you're Cardiff, you're instantly losing out on a number of derbies by moving away to a different league. And again, with the aggressive tiered system, you're not realistically the other three going to agree to that, and that's where we are. And it, you know, it is going to be interesting to see what this report suggests, because, you know, as you mentioned, there's about half a dozen reports sat in a file somewhere in WRU headquarters, and very little's been done about them so far. You know, the sort of the brief with the new hierarchy at the union, sort of the brief conversations I've had, and sort of the impression I get is that they are willing to do something bold and they are keen to make change. But yeah, getting everyone singing on the same hymn sheet is always going to be tricky. I guess, and again, this falls under the category of quick fix that probably doesn't solve things, just like probably Gatland resigning would be in the same thing. But another thing that's probably going to get considered in the coming weeks, certainly that's the implication from quotes from the WRU chair, it's probably going to be the 25 cap rule, isn't it? There's probably going to be some sort of consideration on that. Again, it's a red herring, isn't it, to Welsh rugby's problems. It's not... You know, if you look at it, who's captured?
Joe Hawkins and Alad Davis,
maybe Rhys Patchell.
But he wouldn't be able to play anyway. Otherwise, they wouldn't have signed him in Super Rugby. If he, for him to sign for a Super Rugby team, and if he said, I'm off to play for Wales, they wouldn't have signed him, would they? So,
he could play in the summer tour. If they need him for the summer tour, I'm pretty sure
he could play. Been off for the Six Nations.
But yeah. But even that's sort of shrouded in mystery. And that's the thing is actually, and this is what people moan about the 25 cap rule, but there's actually more ambiguity on the part of the rule that's actually mean it captures less players than it should.
Yeah.
So you criticize the rule for all this, and it's not even as strict as it should be. So that's just another thing in Welsh rugby, but I don't know what they'll do with that.
There's a lot of it's a nuanced sort of debate, isn't it? Because if you look at somebody like an Aaron Wainwright who was linked to Leicester, if he'd gone to Leicester, you know, played in front of massive crowd of Welford Road, one of the best packs in Europe, et cetera, would it have made him a better player? Probably yes. It depends what club you sign for, obviously. But by the same token, there's two things. It should be an aim of the Welsh Rugby Union to have successful professional teams, so you want to keep your best players in Wales for that. And secondly, and I don't understand why people don't get this, is that the cap law is there in the main to help the national side, not the regions, because in the Six Nations campaign, English and French-based players miss the training camp leading up to it. You know, they have to go back on follow weekends. They have to go back on the weekend of a test match if they're not selected in the 23, for example. So if you had, and it depends what, if it's like, if Dan Bigger was still playing, you could sort of, you just fit back in. But if it's a younger player, like a Max Llewellyn, for example, and it's going to be hard, isn't it? And Gatland, obviously, he mentioned about Nick Tompkins having to go back to Saracens and how that didn't help for selection for the French game. So if you had like over 50% of your squad playing outside of Wales, your chances of success is probably going to drop even further. It's stating the obvious. The more time a coach has with players, the better chance you've got of getting a cohesive game plan, an effective game plan to win a test match. So that, you know, there are pros and cons, but that's the sort of the access point is what swings it in favour of keeping it.
And I can see scenarios down the line where it does become obsolete. You know, like let's say, for example, and his future is by no means decided yet, so he could still be a sort of a turning point. But if Mason Grady went to England and decided that actually playing for Wales isn't as important to me as where I'm playing my club rugby, that would be a big blow for the 25 cap rule. And then maybe it becomes a turning point because, you know, other players have gone, you know, Rhys Carey's going, but at the end of the day, Rhys Carey wasn't in Wales's plans. So it's not, it doesn't feel like a blow to the rule. But if, you know, if a Mason Grady went, then yeah, maybe you are heading towards that point where the law is obsolete because even the lure that the Welsh jersey isn't enough to keep players in Wales based on what's being offered here. You know, I think I used the analogy before that effectively it's shutting the gate, but you know, the field has no fence around it.
Yeah.
But yeah. We're not at that point yet, I don't think, you know.
Nowhere near, really.
No, you know, Hawkins is captured. And in fact, you know, Hawkins is an interesting case because, you know, you can talk for hours on whether he's been made an example of it or, you know, so many different things. And it's funny, you know, almost the latest amendment or rewrite or discovery within the rules about basically what keeps Jared Evans eligible and what makes Rhys Patchell effectively eligible. In the fact that they weren't offered fair contracts is all the more interesting when you think of Joe Hawkins because the poor lad was on 20 grand a year. Academy
the Ospreys would claim that, so he was on 20 grand a year, obviously would have been topped up by Wales appearances.
Yeah.
But the new contract the Ospreys offered him was significantly higher. So I suppose, obviously, I don't know what the figure was, but obviously, I suppose that's the issue,
exactly. But anything above 20 grand would be considered probably fair sense. Yeah. So it's an interesting, but you know, that was a very bizarre and sort of nuanced thing. And you know, people have very different opinions on that. But again, he's the only player. Well, him and Alan Davis, who, you know, has shown no signs of wanting to come back. He's enjoying his time at Saracens. You know, he went there when they were relegated.
Yeah.
And, you know, he stayed there and become an important part of them. So, yeah, we're just nowhere near the 25 cap rule being an issue. You know, it's people moan about, I think people talk about it being almost restriction of trade, which is never the case because it's an invitational team. But you do, you know, there is a scenario in the future where you do almost get towards the point of it almost being blackmail, where, you know, if you can't offer a good enough deal in Wales, then you're basically using the Wales jersey as, if not restriction of trade, then almost emotional blackmail. But we're just not at that point yet. And that's why it's such a red herring, I think. But one that probably more than anything people consider to be the problem, which is, you know, it's interesting. That seems to be the breaking point for so many people.
Yeah. But I don't think, as you said, I don't think we're actually close to that yet, because if you're like a solid international class player in Wales and you're regularly playing for Wales, it's still a good wage. It's not like, obviously you can earn more in France and stuff, but there's always like pros and cons. You know, if you go to France, you go away from like all your friends and family, and it's not for everyone. So I think that the point is the players have a choice. It's the same in any walk of life. You know, if you got offered a better job with a bit more money in, I don't know, Birmingham or something, but it meant you had to go away from your family and you couldn't do certain things, and you have to weigh it up. You can't always have your cake and eat it. And that's the key point. The players have still got a choice, haven't they? You know? And if Warren Gatland thinks that, and you know, having extra access to players, he needs that extra access to have a chance of being successful. And maybe that means picking a player that's slightly inferior to a certain player that's gone to France, then he's entitled to do that. It's just, that's the key point. They've all got a choice. They can either stay in Wales and it's still a decent career, or they can just go all out for the money and get, if you're a good player, get into 25 caps, you can get there quite fast anyway. So
yeah. And, you know, the grass isn't always greener. You know, Joe Hawkins is captured, but Max Llewellyn isn't.
Yeah.
And if we're being honest, if Max Llewellyn was playing his playing in Wales right now, he'd have been in that Six Nations squad. He's gone to Gloucester. Probably hasn't had the minutes he was hoping for. Although saying I saw Russ Petty do a stat of Welsh centres, and he's still top for game line dominance.
Yeah. Eddie James is quite high as well.
Eddie James is high. Which probably leads us into, I guess, the final point is, Gatland's been criticised for his selection. I think certainly in the latter part of the Six Nations, you know, it baffles me that Will Rowland started one match in this tournament. He doesn't seem settled. I don't think he seems settled on the centres. I mean, he joked earlier in the tournament that he couldn't play Warren Ball because of Nick Tompkins. We're probably reaching a point now where maybe he's actually wanting to get back to that. Mason Grady's not going to be wearing the 12 at the Arms Park anytime soon. Matt Sherritt sees him as a wing. And just, you know, at the end of the day, Matt Sherritt's philosophy is it doesn't matter what number he wears on his back, you just get him in the game. Which is what, you know, which is fair enough. You know, that's what Wales used to do with George North at 14. So, just, you know. But, I think there's been a lot of talk about Wales' lack of physicality, and there are no quick fixes of that. We've spoken about this on the podcast before, that's a development thing which will, you know, take time and years and investment. And, you know, there are some quick fixes. I mean, you can certainly look for Welsh qualified players and exiled players.
But how many players have a Welsh grandmother across the globe? You know,
that's the thing, isn't it? But without going back to Cameron Hanekom. but, you know, I think that's one way of doing it. It's got to be grandmothers from Guernsey. If Rhys Carey can play for Scotland and Ireland and England, it's got to be some.
I think that would be, if that happens, I think I'd be an embarrassment on Welsh rugby. I just think, you know, it's a fair point. If he's not reaching, if he's not pulling his weight and stuff, and I'm not saying that he's not, then obviously like a coach is entitled not to pick him. It's a reasonable reason not to pick him. But like, I just look at him and I think Wales lack carriers, explosive carriers, and he is one of those. And shouldn't we be looking at the positive and just trying to get that out of him? Because Gatland's had players who've had problems in the past, like an Andy Powell and a Gavin Henson, and he's tried to get the best out of them. So why would Rhys Carey be different? Maybe, you know, he's probably, Gatland's got his reasons, and he may well be right, because there's probably stuff we don't know about. But I just think that would be, it wouldn't reflect well on Welsh rugby.
It's tough, isn't it? Because two Wales coaches have both held the same opinion, clearly. But you know, I think you look elsewhere in the team, and there are probably alternatives in terms of bringing in physicality. As you mentioned, Eddie James, Max Tuellen in the centre. If they want to go down that route of a 12, who is a ball, you know, hits the, you know, carries over the gain line, there are probably options there.
Bryn Bradley, you know, at Harlequins, starting to play as well.
Yeah, even sort of, you know, maybe in the back row, you've got ball carries to come back in, because maybe that was where Wales' back row didn't quite have the right dynamic. But then, you know, people have written off Toby Faletau. You know, talking about whether he should come back in, they forget genuinely how good he was in the World Cup. You got Jack Morgan to come back in. Obviously, Dewi Lake's there. There are players to come back in, but front row is the weirdest area, I think, when it comes to Wales as Six Nations. You know, was it five different tight heads?
And none convinced.
Yeah, and then you look at, you know, obviously Carey is one example. Nicky Smith is another. That's where probably his selection is questioned. There's a lot of talk about the need to go through pain in the short term to build long term, but how much of that pain is necessary and how much of it is self-inflicted? And I think when you look at the front row, that's where that question is really sort of asked.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you look at like a Harry O'Connor. I don't want to pick on him. You know, he plays in a Scarlet team that against Munster, not even Munster's strongest team, and he has a torrid time at the scrum. I know the scrum's an eight-man effort, but the tight end is called the cornerstone for a reason. He has a torrid time, and then he gets called up by Wales on the Monday. So that tells you two things. Number one, we've got the depth of tight end, and it's almost like at tight end, we're just picking up young players at random and just hoping for the best. You know, it's almost like that, because that's just one area of the game. You know, even when Adam Jones played for Wales, on the whole, you could say he wasn't the strongest area. He was the best tight end in the world by country mile. But behind, whenever he got injured, we didn't have a scrum. We found Samson Lee could have been that, but he had the Achilles thing. And we found Thomas Francis, and he did a reasonable job. But it's always really, on the whole, been a weak area. And I just look around Welsh rugby, you know, obviously, we could go back to Francis in the summer. I probably would do that if he's available. But we just don't have the... I just don't see anyone. You know, Archie Griffin, too early to say. There's some... You know, Asarati played well against England, but didn't back it up. Worth persevering with. But I don't see any sort of top-class prospect. I just don't... Hopefully, the people like Harry O'Connor prove me wrong, but it's a huge weakness. There's no getting away from that.
Indeed it is. I think that's where we'll leave today's podcast. We've covered quite a bit. I don't know if we're any closer to knowing quite where Welsh rugby's going and where it sort of fixes some of its problems. But hopefully that's all going to be revealed in the coming weeks and months. It's going to be an interesting 2024, isn't it? The wooden spoon's been coming, hasn't it, for a long time, if we're being honest. And some people would argue it's what we need to sort of implement change. I think you never really should need to hit rock bottom to actually implement change. I think that's just good forward thinking and succession planning. But we are where we are, as has been said many times in the Six Nations, and we'll just have to see what comes next. But yeah, there's certainly quite a lot to mull over. And now we just await for that strategic plan to come out in June.
Yeah, it's going to be a long 3 months.
I mean, yeah, I guess that's the final point of the podcast. Is there a need for that review to almost be brought forward? Is that possible? Can they? I mean, where are they with that What is the state of that review at the minute?
Last I heard was that the first strategy PRB meetings were last week. So I suppose if those are the first meetings, then you know they're nowhere near finished. I don't think it's something you can rush.
No.
I mean, we're in a bad position anyway, aren't we? So I don't think it's something we should be rushing. And even if we put the right structures in place, it's going to take quite a while to sort of see any sort of success, unfortunately. So I don't think it should be rushed.
Absolutely. So there we have it. That's today's podcast, Done and Dusted. A bit of a somber listen, probably, but I mean, you probably weren't tuning in to a post-Wood and Spoon podcast expecting laugh a minute, but if you have enjoyed the podcast, do make sure to drop us a review. It really does help us out. And subscribe for all the latest fallout from the Wooden Spoon and all the reaction. You can, of course, catch all that on Wales Online. But until the next podcast, goodbye.